Why is America living in an age of profound economic inequality? Why, despite the desperate need to address climate change, have even modest environmental efforts been defeated again and again? Why have protections for employees been decimated? Why do hedge fund billionaires pay a far lower tax rate than the middle-class workers? The conventional answer is that a popular uprising against big government led to the ascendancy of a broad-based conservative movement. But as New Yorker staff writer and New York Times bestselling author Jane Mayer shows in her new book, Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right, a network of exceedingly wealthy people with extreme libertarian views bankrolled a systematic, step-by-step plan to fundamentally alter the American political system. Jane Mayer joins us this morning to talk about dark money, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm happy to join you.
You've been working on this for a long time. I'm interested what brought you to the subject and what you were ultimately interested in finding out.
Well, a few things. I mean, I cover politics for the New Yorker magazine in Washington, and before that I covered it for the Wall Street Journal. So I've been in Washington now, God, way too long, a couple decades. And I have been watching a few things and wondering what was really going on kind of behind the curtains. One is that the government just seemed increasingly dysfunctional. And I wondered, you know, why is it that much of the country has, there's actually some consensus on points of view on a number of issues, like most people think that climate change is real and something should be done about it. Most people like Social Security and want to see it strengthened. Most people, if you look at the polls, a majority want the minimum wage increased. These are just sort of kind of run-of-the-mill centrist positions for most Americans, yet nothing's getting done about any of this in Washington. So I wondered, you know, what is it that is tying the government up in knots? And as I sort of poked around, one of the things I found was that there are huge private interests pouring money in behind the scenes and to some extent kind of capturing the government and making it serve their own private interests. And among those, one of the biggest forces is one family, two brothers, the Koch brothers, who are huge industrialists originally from Wichita, Kansas, and they're the fifth and sixth richest men in the world. They've been playing a very tough game to try to push the political system to go their way. And they're not alone. The book is about others, too, who have really changed the landscape politically with their money in recent years.
Talk to me a little bit about the timeline and what you chose, because you have an interesting point here that a lot of this begins, or a good place to start in the story, is right after the inauguration of President Obama. But obviously, this timeline can go back much further.
Well, it does go back much further, and that's why this is really a book instead of just a magazine article. It tells the story of a 40-year plan by a few very, very fringe figures in the country who were extraordinarily wealthy, who didn't like what was going on in America in the 1970s. They especially didn't like the environmental movement. They didn't like the consumer movement, sort of Ralph Nader. They just didn't like what they regarded as the government reaching into their business, and most of them were big businessmen, and many of them had records of huge pollution in their companies. There's a paper I've got here where I have Charles Koch, who's the head of Koch Industries, talking about 1976, how what he wants to do is launch a secretive movement to destroy what he calls the statist paradigm. By that he means, you know, government regulations and things like that. This is 1976. It's a long time ago. He had been a member of the John Birch Society, the far right wing group that saw communist conspiracies everywhere and thought that, for instance, President Eisenhower was a communist. He'd been a member with his dad in this group, and he wanted to copy the secrecy of the John Birch Society and build up a movement, and started thinking about how do you change American politics. And he's an engineer. He's a graduate of MIT. And he kind of built what was basically an assembly line to manufacture political change in the country very consciously. And he looked at, what do you do to change people's minds if you've got a lot of money? Well, he thought you needed to attack the universities, put professors in who will teach kids your point of view. And the Kochs in particular have, they've got now 220 to 300 programs in universities. Build up think tanks that will push your point of view and make it sound like it's a competing point of view with what the more traditional scholars think. So if you want to say, for instance, that global warming isn't real, you subsidize a lot of scientists who will put out studies saying it's not real and the polar bears are doing fine, and they have done that. Then mainstream this material into the culture so that Americans get very confused. They're not sure which experts to listen to. They also made a huge push on the courts. They hold judicial seminars for federal judges. They've gotten a number of Supreme Court justices, many, many justices on the federal bench, and try to convince them that regulations hurt business and are bad for America, on particularly environmental regulations. So in many different points, they've looked at this, and then they've also built up grassroots groups. And one of the things that's quite amazing is how successful they've been in creating this movement. So the network of multimillionaires and billionaires around the Kochs, there's only 400 or 450 very super rich people now, are funding, it's sort of like a third party, almost a plutocratic party. It's got a bigger budget than the Republican National Committee had in 2012. And something like three times more employees. So they've got kind of like their own national political party, and it's pushing out there with organizations like Americans for Prosperity that go door to door and sign people up to vote and mobilize people and pressure people in office and then elect people to office.
Let's get to a couple of follow-ups, points that you just made that I would like to clarify, because I find this fascinating. One of the points that you make in the book is that these are big Republican donors who are not always fans of the Republicans, that they do not line up straight behind the Republican Party.
That's true. And we've heard Charles Koch in recent times talking about his disappointment in, for instance, Donald Trump and some of the other candidates for not doing more what he'd like to see them do. What's interesting, as someone who covers politics, is this is a force, a group that is to the right of the Republican Party, and that's why the book's described as, you know, the history of the radical right. The Kochs, Charles and David, opposed Ronald Reagan, for instance, in 1980. David ran as vice president of the Libertarian Party against Ronald Reagan because they thought that Reagan was too liberal. So they stand to the far right of the Republican Party. And there's a new paper out from Harvard that came out about 2 weeks ago by a professor there. It's called The Koch Effect, and it studies what effect they're having on American politics, they and a group of very wealthy allies. And it describes them as a force field that's magnetically pulling the Republican Party to the right. And again, where we began talking here was about, well, so why is it that sort of centrist views in America on ordinary issues don't get addressed? And part of the reason is that the people who've got so much influence and money in the Republican Party right now, who are big donors, they tend to be more radical than the centrist voters or even the rank and file. And so they have different interests. They, for instance, are against raising taxes on the super rich like themselves. They're against environmental regulations on their own businesses. And there's a sort of a space where the ordinary middle-class voters are kind of not having their interests heard that much because this small group has so much influence.
Are they solely out for the Koch brothers, or do they really have an ideology that they are trying to spread far beyond just their own wealth?
It's always impossible for political reporters to tell where ideology ends and corruption begins. You know, you can't get into people's heads. I would say that they are both. There are fanatical ideologues. They are tremendous believers in the free market, but that also serves their political and their private interests at the same time. It's just hard to tell, but the positions they're taking in American politics dovetail with their self-interest. But they would say, in, you know, to take their side for a minute here, they would say that what they're doing is good for America. I mean, and I think they probably believe it. You know, they create jobs. They employ something like 60,000 people in America. They make products that we all know, Vanity Fair napkins and Dixie cups, and they have huge numbers of pipelines and fossil fuel refineries. And, you know, they do things that they think are good for America. They see themselves as what's good for them is good for the country.
Jane Mayer is our guest. The name of the book is Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. It is published by Doubleday. You talk about their influence in elections. You talk about their influence in the courts. Have they, will they be able to buy a presidential election?
The presidential election is the hardest thing to buy. The Kochs and their organization have had tremendous influence at lower levels in American politics, in state houses, legislatures all across the country, and in congressional races and Senate races. Those races, money goes further, and also there's less press attention to it. Those candidates don't get as much free publicity, and you can have more influence by being able to buy ads. The presidential race is a tall order to buy in this country, and I'm not at all sure that they will succeed at it. But they have gathered around them a group that has put together a jackpot that they're waiting to put behind any Republican candidate who kind of sings their song, really. And most of the Republican candidates for president have been courting this money. Not all of them. Trump hasn't, but pretty much the others have. And it's a jackpot that they originally said would reach $889 million. And that's an incredible amount of money, even today in American politics. And it can go far.
How often do they just contribute to candidates with that money? Because it's ultimately about $300 million that they will spend directly on elections. Is that true?
So they've said they've earmarked something like $300 million of it directly for campaigns. And the rest of it is money that goes to things like issue ads and policy promotion and mobilizing voters. They have a very sophisticated data network that is, by all accounts, much better than that of the Republican Party at this point. That kind of thing that sort of helps, you know, move the country in their direction. It's fascinating to me to see that Trump's doing so well, because in a way I think he's playing against this, even though he's a billionaire himself, which makes for a kind of a limited choice in terms of, you know, you can either have the candidates who are backed by the billionaires or the billionaire candidate who backs himself. But at any rate, I think that the public is kind of disgusted with the idea that a few hundred of the richest people in the country might choose their leader for them. No matter what your politics, most people, they really like the old-fashioned idea of one man, one vote in this country. And they don't want the course of the country decided by the few richest people. And so I think some of the backlash against these mega donors is helping Trump, who looks like he's his own man, whatever else you think of him.
The dark money that you talk about in the book, the title, of course, Dark Money. So how much do we really know where it goes? How much dollar for dollar can we actually follow?
The main answer I would have to that is not enough. And
right.
I mean, I think that the public has every right to know how individuals of huge wealth and power are trying to influence the country. And it's very, very hard to follow the money. And it's my job and that of many other reporters to try to figure this out. But you hit a brick wall. The dark money groups are, just to put it, you know, clearly, they're called 501c4s. They're supposed to be charities. They're supposed to be public welfare groups that are doing things in the public interest and not primarily being political. But and for the, in exchange for the tax-exempt status that they get, they can hide the identities of their donors. And these groups, this kind of strange organization, have become the single greatest loophole in American politics right now. Money is pouring into them because the donors don't want the American public to know who they are. And it's very hard for reporters to figure it out, too. Take the Koch network in particular. They are 400 to 450 very wealthy conservative people. Most of their identities are secret. But in my book, what I tried to do was get behind the curtain and tell people, who are these people? And luckily, one guest list got left behind in a hotel someplace. So we know some of who they are, and some of them are very well-known people. I mean, these are not just businessmen from Kansas. They include some of the biggest financiers in New York, people like Steve Schwarzman, who is a well-known billionaire hedge funder. There are a handful of others. You kind of have like a X-ray of some of the biggest, most powerful interests in the country just coagulated in this one group.
Does money buy you the interest of the Koch brothers, the amount of money you have, or does it have to come with the political ideology as well? Meaning the groups that they will get together, the other billionaires and the other, this network that they work with of other very rich people, it is based not on the money, it is based on these libertarian beliefs.
They actually, in their organization, it's not all libertarians. These are not just sort of two-dimensional, you know, cartoon characters. They are a range of people who have somewhat different views. Some of them are hawks on foreign policy. Some of them are doves, like many of the libertarians. But what brings them together, the shared glue in this group, is a detestation of taxes and regulations on business. So you get someone like Sheldon Adelson, who is a billionaire casino operator out in Nevada, who is a super hawk on the subject of Israel, and he doesn't agree with the Kochs on their point of view about foreign policy, but he wants very, you know, weak government regulations. And that is pretty much what unites this group. I mean, Steve Schwarzman, is who I mentioned earlier, he's not a hugely right-wing libertarian, but he is someone who really wants to keep the tax loophole open on hedge funds. It's called the carried interest loophole. And so he wants to keep that tax low and has described in the past any attempt to change it, close that loophole, as being like the Nazis. He apologized for that later because it was such an overstatement. But these are people who care intensely about keeping their taxes low.
Jane Mayer is the author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. The book is published by Doubleday. I want to spend a few moments on the family itself. So there are four sons. When we talk about the Koch brothers, we usually mean Charles and David. There are two other brothers, Frederick and Bill. What is the division between the brothers?
They split in two teams, basically. They fought for 20 years over the family fortune and for control of the family company, Koch Industries. And they were in and out of the courts, and it was just a knockdown, drag-out fight with each side hiring their own private detectives. And it was really a dirty fight. And one of the things I describe in this book that is really, I think, well, it's, I'll let your listeners judge for themselves. But at one point, three of the brothers ganged up on the fourth, and they accused him of being gay. And they sat him down in a kind of a kangaroo court and said that if he didn't hand over his shares in the family company to them, that they would tell their father that he was gay and that he would be disinherited, and that it might really hurt their father's health. So it was basically a blackmail attempt at one of their own brothers. It was long ago, but it was pretty ruthless. And you see these guys fighting very ruthlessly with each other and with other people. They're tough players.
Frederick is the oldest, who's accused of being gay. He is essentially out of the picture. He doesn't get involved in the family business. And as you point out in the book, that you don't think he even speaks to Charles, or that there was a lot of bad blood left there, obviously.
There is a lot of bad blood left, though for many years brother Bill, who was on the team with Fred, Bill didn't speak to his twin, who is David, and I think there's been some kind of rapprochement there. But it's Charles who's really the driver of a lot of the action in the family and the driver of the ideology in the family, and Fred and he do not speak. Fred's gone off to do a lot of things in the arts. He's a very generous donor to both the Shakespeare Theater in Britain and to the opera in New York. So he didn't fit into this rough and tumble family that was from the oil patch.
When you look at that family makeup and the background, to me it gave a lot of context. For you, in learning that story, does it tell you more about who these two men, who the men that we think of as the Koch brothers, Charles and David, does it help give them a context as to who they are and how they operate?
Well, to me it does. I mean, I always find people's family histories fascinating, and I think they're important. And the figure looming large over these boys when they were growing up was their father, the original Fred Koch. And he was a brilliant engineer who figured out how a better way of turning oil into gasoline. But at the same time, he was really tough on his sons. And I have descriptions of him taking tree branches off the trees and stripping them down into switches, and just the one eyewitness describes him as whipping the boys like dogs. And he loomed large over them, and the Charles, who was I think a very rebellious kid, he was thrown out of something like 8 different schools. He rebelled against this, and you can kind of see him, you know, becoming very anti-rules, which is sort of akin to libertarianism, you know, let me be free. But at the same time, he was also tremendously competitive and controlling. And he controls Koch Industries with an iron hand. I mean, I describe that. That's literally a quote from somebody there. David is much less so. He's the brother who's in New York. He's the richest resident of Manhattan, richer than Bloomberg. And he's sort of more of like the tag-along with his older brother, Charles.
You talk in the book that there were some forays into politics, and eventually it was decided, and it seems like a rather conscious decision, that they would be more behind the scenes than running for politics themselves.
Well, sure. I mean, they were defeated badly. I mean, their ideas were not popular in America in 1980 when they ran. They got, you know, something like 1% of the vote for the Libertarian ticket, and that was after the Kochs had poured, you know, $1 million or more into their own candidacy. So they realized they couldn't win over America the old-fashioned Democratic way with elections and votes, and they would have to do something else if they were going to bring the country in their direction. And they are somewhat contemptuous of the politicians anyway. I mean, there's a description, Brian Doherty, who is a libertarian who wrote the history of libertarianism in America, explains that they viewed politicians as just actors who are acting out their parts. And the Kochs decided after 1980, he says, that they wanted to write the script. They didn't want to just elect them. They want to write the script. And so that's what they set out to do. And that was, you know, quite some time ago, and they've been doing it ever since. It's a really long game. It's fascinating. I mean, it's kind of like a secret attempt to really take over American politics with a fortune. And they weren't alone. I have to emphasize, this is, you know, the book, the Koch brothers get all the attention,
right?
But there's some other fantastically interesting families. There's the Richard Mellon Scaife, who is the heir to the Gulf oil fortune. And he estimates he spent $1 billion, 600 and something million of it, on politics. People very rarely even know who he is, but he was described by Attorney General Edwin Meese as the hidden hand in American politics. And so I've just tried to kind of bring these hidden hands out in the open so people can see, if they wonder why the country's kind of gone in some of the directions it's gone in, these funders have played a very big and determined part.
I want to end here, and that is with this hidden hand and wanting to write the script. Where we are right now in our presidential politics, who could have written this script?
You mean with Trump and Bernie Sanders, the outsiders becoming
yes.
the insiders? Well, again, I think that what we're looking at is something of a kind of the public's disgust at the feeling that so many candidates are so owned by private interests and by these big mega donors. I think, you know, after Citizens United, money just poured into American politics secretly. And originally people thought it would come from companies, but most companies don't really want to risk doing that. So instead, what's happened is spectacularly rich individuals who have very strong opinions are the ones that are pouring money in. And I think the voters kind of are uncomfortable with this idea that, you know, a few of the richest people in the country might seem to have undue influence over our candidates. So they've gravitated to two candidates who break that mold. That said, I'm not sure by Election Day, which is quite a long ways off, yeah. that we're going to see either of those outsiders win, because there's a lot to go between now and then.
There is, but there is also a possibility that they can write the script, but those who are running and the American people don't have to follow it.
I think that's absolutely right. And I have personally, having covered politics now for something like 35 years, I have to say I have a lot of faith in the American public. I think what they need is information, though. That's why I wrote this book. People have got to read the story. They've got to understand what the interests are behind the curtain so they can evaluate what's going on. And I think they make pretty wise decisions when they have the information, but they've got to get the information here.
Jane Mayer is the author of the new book, Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. The book is published by Doubleday. Jane Mayer, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing time with us.
Thanks for having me.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Dark Money by Jane Mayer. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.